Good morning, guys. It's great to see you today. Thanks for being here at Ashworth. I'm Brent. I'm the lead pastor here. And today we're going to be wrapping up a series that we've been in the past two Sundays. And you can see from the screen, it's been called Seduced. And the reason we're looking at these is because just as a part of human nature, these three things that we're looking at are the three things that we are most susceptible to being seduced by. And honestly, this isn't a judgment about you or about me, because as I said, it's mainly about human nature, and it's the things that tug so much at us. It's the cultural values that we see and we're enticed by. And if we're not careful, we'll find ourselves moving towards those seductions. But as we've seen over the last couple of weeks, there is a way that Jesus presents to us, a different way, a competing way that brings to us some values that are different than maybe what we're feeling tugged towards. And we have to find ways to fight against that human nature and resist those seductions. And today we're going to talk about one. We're wrapping up the series with this topic, and I'm sure it's one that none of you struggle with, but we need to talk about it anyway. And I will say, I know that at least I don't struggle with it, and it's the seduction of stuff. The seduction of stuff. And I say this, I say funnily, I don't struggle with this, because to be honest, when I think about this, I think, oh no, this isn't a big deal to me. It's not something I really struggle with. This is other people, and I'll point fingers at some of you, you know. But then on Labor Day, this last Monday, Carrie and I decided to do some kind of deeper cleaning in our house. And one of the areas we decided to address was our closet in our bedroom. And we started working, and we kept working, and we kept working until we pulled out so many trash bags of clothes to donate that I don't even want to tell you how many. Okay, it was 10. We took out 10 trash bags of clothes between the two of us to donate to Goodwill. And what I would love to tell you is that in our closet was sparse, but it wasn't. It was still packed full, even with 10. Now, to be fair, over the last couple years, I've dropped a little weight. Some of the clothes I got rid of were the fat clothes, so they took up more space in the trash bag. So that's what I'm justifying. That's what I'm saying. The bigger waisted, you know, that extra 2 inches there takes up more space. So, no, I'm embarrassed by that. Now, we donated it and did good with it and all that, but, you know, if you were to say, Brent, are you seduced by stuff? I'd be like, no, not at all. But I think we are. And then there's this other thing, and you guys are going to be like, oh, Lord, my pastor's a nerd. You know this. I mean, it just happens. I don't think I'm seduced by stuff until last week I read that. Oh, do you guys know what's happening Tuesday of this week? Anybody? Something about Apple. You know it's right. Tim Cook is going to take the stage on Tuesday of this week, and guess what? He's going to tell us what we've been waiting a year to hear. The new iPhone. Whoa, I know. You're all like, oh, Lord, Brent, get over yourself. But I don't feel like I'm that into things until certain things happen, like I clean out my closet or I see Tim Cook that's going to tell me the new latest and greatest iPhone that I need. And to be fair, I didn't upgrade last year. And so you said I'm doing already? Yeah, you're laughing, see, because you know it's true, because now I'm starting to justify, right? I'm starting to justify. And see, and the way things go in my house is when I get a phone, all phones roll downhill. And so Carrie gets my older one, and then Carrie's goes to one of the children in the house. So see, I'm helping needy children by upgrading my iPhone. See, this is not a bad thing. But the question, you know, I have to ask myself is, are you going to upgrade? I don't know yet. I haven't decided, because I don't want to answer the next question is this: do you really need one? The one I have in my pocket works just fine. It gets and receives calls. I go down the list of other reasons to justify, like giving it to my kids and all this. But I feel that trap, that tug. And if I upgrade, is it wrong? If I don't upgrade, does it make me better? And I realize that some of you are like, Brent, you're nuts because you're such an Apple freak, and I get that. I own it well. But I encourage you to think about your own life. Maybe your particular vice is not the iPhone. God forbid it's that Android garbage, but it could be. We're praying for you. But maybe you're seduced by other things. Maybe it is clothes, or maybe you have hobbies, sporting activities, travels, kids' activities. things for your kitchen, things for your house. Maybe it's your house, maybe it's your cars. You see, the problem with this is that when you begin to study the psychology behind it, you understand that when these seductions, all of them, they hit our brains in a certain way, and it's the pleasure center of the brain. And when we do these certain behaviors, that part of the brain lights up, and it creates pleasure, and we enjoy it. And that's why they're so seductive. That's why we have such temptation, is because if it didn't feel good, we wouldn't do it. And so when it comes to status and power, we feel that urge that when we get to a place and we're recognized, we think, ah, look at me, I've arrived. And that creates that pleasure, and that brain lights up, and we want more. And with sex, we find the same thing, that it's pleasurable, and that's why we want to do it. And for others, it comes when we buy things. It's that retail therapy that just makes me feel better, whether I need the stuff I'm buying or not. And the problem, though, with buying new stuff is when it makes us feel good. Because in that moment, we get to feel like somebody different. And our value, who we are as an individual, who we are as a person, becomes based on the stuff we have rather than on who we are and who God says we are. And what happens, unfortunately, is sometimes we get addicted to upgrading when we don't necessarily need to buying a new car, buying more stuff, until you get 10 extra trash bags of clothes in your closet and you have piles and piles of stuff. And then it's inevitable. The new things that brought us so much pleasure quickly become old things. And then what needs to happen then? Ah, I need to feel better. So what do? I go buy new things again. And it's a vicious cycle that we get locked into. So how do we fight the seduction of stuff? What does Jesus, what does the Bible have to teach us about this? And is there any hope for somebody who's trapped in this seduction of stuff? Well, you'd be surprised maybe to know that Jesus and Paul both were very willing to talk about money. Today we're going to look at what Paul says. But Jesus, even if you go through the New Testament, Matthew talked about it this morning and right before the offering. Jesus actually talked about money more than he talked about heaven or hell or faith or prayer. It was one of the top topics that he always talked about. And it's for the exact reason Matthew shared this morning. It's because so much of how we view and value money and stuff is tied to our heart. And it really reveals more about us than I think we want to acknowledge. The Apostle Paul also talks a lot about money. And in his first letter to his protege, Timothy, he concludes this letter by telling Timothy how to talk to people about money. And in 1 Timothy chapter 6 is where we're going to be today. Paul talks about two different types of people. In the first part of the chapter, he talks to those who don't have money and those who desire money. And he talks about the dangers and the struggles. And that's where we get the famous passage. We say it wrong often. We say, oh, money's the root of all evil. That's not what Paul says. Paul says the love of money is the root of evil. And he cautions people against chasing the dollar, getting rich quick, and finding your value in chasing money. And Paul tells Timothy to teach people to stop chasing it, and that be cautious when it comes to money, because riches can prevent and stop your faith from growing. I mean, Jesus made crazy statements like, it's easier for a camel to go through the eye of a needle than it is for a rich man to enter heaven. What a powerful statement. There's a danger that exists. And Paul, even as he's talking to Timothy, he says, you know, the sad thing is there's even been some that have left the faith because of money to pursue riches. But a little bit later in chapter 6, and it's where I want us to focus our attention today, Paul writes these words. We're going to look at verse 17. They're going to be on the screen. He begins and Paul says this. He says to Timothy, he says, command those who are rich in this present world. Now, for some of you, I can hear your thoughts. You may not know this, but as we preach, we can hear your thoughts. It's an amazing spiritual gift, and some of you should be very ashamed right now. No. As I read these words, command those who are rich in this present world, there are many of you that just thought, all right, I can check what time kickoff starts. Let me see what's happening on Facebook, because that's not talking about me. Who, me? I'm not rich. Comfortable maybe, but rich? No, no. But before you check out on me this morning, let's dive into this idea of what does it mean to be rich? As I said, most of us would probably say, I'm not rich, I'm comfortable, I have enough, but rich? No, no, no. But we find that when we begin to define that word rich, it becomes kind of a moving target, doesn't it? It becomes kind of this very random number that sits out here in the sphere that we're trying to throw darts at that we just can't seem to hit. So for example, I was studying this week and I came across a study and in the study they asked a group of people, and it was the group of people that made $35,000 a year or less. And they said, how do you define rich? And they said, you know what? Rich is when you make $75,000 a year. Oh, interesting. They went to the group of people that made $75,000 a year and they said, how do you define rich? And what they said is, you know what? Rich is those who make $150,000 a year. And they went to those who make $150,000 a year, and guess what they said? Those who make $300,000 a year are rich. And what we find is rich is always defined as a little bit more than what I currently have. Because it doesn't matter if you have $30,000 or $130 million. There's a point where we're always going, I just need a little bit more, and then I will be rich. Left to ourselves, defining rich is a moving target. There's a website I stumbled across this week called the Global Rich List, and I did some digging. Anybody looked at this website before? It's fascinating. Here's a question for you. So this looks at the world. What annual income do you think you would have to make to be in the world's top 1% of income earners? Now, you know, 1% is a big deal in the U.S. Political season, we're always fighting the 99 versus the 1. Let's take this to the global scale. What do you think? How many of you think it would have to be over $100,000 a year? A few hands. How many of you think more than $100,000 a year? Okay. How many of you say lower, like $50,000 a year? How many of you think lower than $50,000 a year? You guys are smart. The number is this. The number is this. If you make $32,400 a year, it puts you in the top 1% wealthiest people in the world. This website is fascinating because it tells you also, it says you're the 59 millionth richest person in the world. You scroll down and it tells you what you make, what would cost you when you work 20 seconds to earn a soda. It takes somebody in Zimbabwe a whole day, and it breaks it down in amazing ways. It says what you earn in a year, the average laborer in Indonesia takes 43 years to earn, and that's just at $32,400 a year. So we may not think of ourselves as rich, but I'm going to dispel that myth this morning and say, if you live in the United States, if you have four walls and a roof over your head with electricity and you enjoy the central heating and air conditioning as a part of your house, if you had food on your table for the last 7 days and actually had leftovers, if you drive a car that was built within the last 10 years, we'll be generous, 15 years, I'm just here to tell you, you're rich. You are rich in this present world. And if you don't believe me, let me encourage you, buy yourself a plane ticket, which you can do because you're rich, and go to any number of third world countries, and you will soon discover just how much we have to excess. It really does make you feel guilty. We don't think of it, of ourselves as rich. So we can't check out here, honestly, because what Paul has to say 2,000 years ago to a church that had both wealthy and non-wealthy people, it applies to us sitting in this church in America today. You see, I heard a pastor once say that we often confuse being rich with feeling rich. And isn't that a big difference? We don't often feel rich, but we really are. And I'm sure even though most of us don't feel rich, it doesn't mean we aren't. We don't feel rich, though, the pastor went on to say, because we don't have margin. We live to the financial extreme, spending every dime we make, buying and upgrading whether we need to or not. I believe it was Dave Ramsey who made this statement. He said, "We buy things we don't need with money we don't have to impress people we don't like." And I thought, that's kind of an appropriate statement, right? How rich we feel is directly tied to the amount of margin you have in your life. And if we live to the extreme, sure, you're never going to feel rich, and you may not feel that way. But this message is for all of us today. So let's continue on now that we know Paul is speaking to us, and let's figure out what is he saying to us. What is the command that Timothy is supposed to teach those who are rich? So back to verse 17. It says, "Command those who are rich in this present world not to be arrogant, nor to put their hope in wealth, which is so uncertain." Now, Paul begins here with two inherent risks that come with being rich. This is when we, and not even saying, you know, when we're seducted by stuff, when we feel that pull, this is part of it. What can happen to us when we feel that tug on our hearts? And the first thing is this: arrogance. Now, this is an interesting one to me because I'm thinking, how do you mean arrogance? I mean, we all have seen the movies and they portray the wealthy people and they're a bunch of jerks. And it's like, you know, yeah, we hate you because you're a jerk. But not me, right? I'm not arrogant. But then as I thought about this more, I thought, you know, there is an element of wealth that does make us proud. I think in my own life, I think back to ages ago before 27 children, and when we didn't make enough money for anything, the old expression would be we didn't have a pot to pee in or a window to throw it out of. That described Carrie and I in the early days of our marriage. And you know what I found in that day was we never went without food. We lived paycheck to paycheck. It was often tight. When it came time to replace a car, I can remember I paid $1,500 for a pickup truck that had no air conditioning because that's what I could afford. And I found myself in that moment on my knees a lot more, praying to God, seeking God for help, asking God for provision, because guess what? I needed it. There were genuine needs in my life. It wasn't to upgrade an iPhone. It was needs to have food and cars that run to get us to work and to be able to give to the church and to help other people. Those were the things that we prayed about. But as we've gotten older and our income has risen, I'm sad to say that I find myself on my knees less and less asking God for provision. Why would that be? What would keep me from getting on my knees and praying to God and say, God, help me meet my needs? You know what it is? Arrogance. I'm proud. No, I'm not boasting proud. Look at me. Look how much money I've got. No. But it's the arrogance that says, it's okay, God. I got this. I don't need you right now. And I think I believe that's exactly what Paul is warning Timothy about. To teach all of us that when we have wealth, when we have riches, when we are drawn in by the seduction of stuff, we become self-confident and self-reliant, and God becomes less and less of what we need and depend on. And it's not only that, but I think as my reliance on myself increases, not only that, but my self-worth and how I view myself is tied up in my money as well. How I view how I'm doing. If my bank account is high, I feel good. If it's low, I feel bad. And I think maybe you don't believe me there. But let me ask you, let's take away your job, your savings account, your retirement account. Take away your house, your cars, and your clothes. How do you feel about yourself now? You see, I think all of us would like to say, oh, I feel fine, and I'm going to say, you lie. Because all of us, through the seduction of wealth in our culture, find a little bit of who we are, our value in what we have. You see, it's easy to allow the fact that we have money to give us an inflated self-image. We believe I am somebody because of what I have. And if we aren't careful, this can become a feeling of entitlement. I have what I have and I deserve it. And before we know it, we get caught in a loop of discontentment. I need more. I want more. I desire more. And that seduction of stuff just never goes away. And no matter how much we have, if we're not careful, we will always say, I want a little more. And I think this leads to the second danger, which is simply this. Paul shows it that we not only get arrogant, but then we put our hope in our wealth. Because I have it, I want to keep it, and I have to protect it. And so if I have it, it makes me feel secure. But the problem is, as we all know, we get a false sense of security. Don't believe me? Anybody here watch the stock market? Anybody here watch it lately? Anybody here listen to NPR's Planet Money podcast? Anybody heard about the inverted yield curve that's the predictor of recessions over the last like 50 years and heard that, oh my goodness, the yield curve has now inverted and it may be time for another recession, and you go, ah, not again. And so what do? We find that if we're not careful, we put our hope in our wealth. And you see, as we've talked about all these seductions of status and sex and stuff, all of them come with big promises. All of them come with big assurances. And the problem is not one of them can live up to the hype. We pursue status and power thinking that's going to give our life value. But even when we get it, we still find it's not enough and we want more and we're empty. And we chase sex and we think that physical act with multiple people will make us feel loved and help us feel loved, only to find that after person, we only increase our shame and the rejection of us, and we feel more devalued than we feel loved. And stuff promises security. Get lots of stuff. Get a big house. Fill your basements to overflowing. And then you'll be secure. Get that large retirement account and all will be fine. But we find that wealth gives us a false sense of security. That next recession is just right around the corner. Always. It's never going to be secure. And what's supposed to give us security becomes our focus, because we have to protect it. And the more we have, the more we have to maintain, and the more we worry about losing it. It gets in a cycle where we have to protect and hoard and keep it. And now before you leave here this morning and think, you know, that pastors are just down on money and Paul didn't like money and stuff, you know, I want you to read a little bit further in verse 17. Before we look at how we can fight the seduction of stuff, because when we keep going in verse 17, look at what Paul says. He says, command those who are rich in this present world not to be arrogant, not to put their hope in wealth, which is uncertain, which we know. He says, but put your hope in God, who richly provides us with, read those last four words with me, everything for our, enjoyment. Say that last word again. Enjoyment. Okay, so what did Paul just say here? What he tells us is, having money is not wrong. This message today isn't to make you feel guilty and say, go give it all away. No, because Paul is saying, look, you have what you have because of God, and he wants you to enjoy it. He wants you to be able to enjoy what you have. Having money isn't wrong. Having stuff isn't wrong. Allowing it to make us arrogant, entitled, and unconcerned about others, that's wrong. Putting our faith in our portfolio instead of the provider, that's wrong. But make no mistake, God is not a cosmic killjoy. He doesn't dangle all these things in front of our faces only to pull them away to show you what you can't have. What kind of father would that be? Not a good one. God has provided you with what you have for your enjoyment. And this isn't just a pastor wanting to appease the American conscience. This is Paul in something written 2,000 years ago, writing to his protege, who he had left at a church to pastor and encourage and build up, talking to a group of people who had money and who didn't. And Paul isn't saying it's all about self-denial, asceticism, but he's also saying it can't be all about you either. And Paul, in this moment, when he says, it's okay if you enjoy things, but let me tell you how to fight the urge of the seduction of stuff. And he's actually already addressed it right here at the beginning of this phrase where he says, but to put your hope in God. Remember, he said, don't put your hope in wealth, because wealth is fleeting. It comes and goes. And you know, there's the old expression that you can't take it with you. If you've been around through the 2008 recession, if you've been here longer than that, you understand that even having it while you're here, there's no guarantee you're going to keep it. It comes and it goes. And he begins and he says, put your hope in God. Put your hope in God. Wealth is uncertain, but Jesus is the sure thing. Money comes and goes, usually goes more at my house than comes. And even if you have a ton of it, there's no certainty there. And even if you talk to people that have a lot of it, what you'll find is that it never can live up to that promise. And even though wealth and riches and stuff may provide comfort, it never can provide contentment. And that's the problem. Because if it doesn't get us to contentment, we find ourselves continuing to reach and grab for more. Paul knows that we can quickly and easily make wealth a substitute for God. Our hope can shift from what God has done for us to our ability to amass wealth. And that is never a sure foundation. God is a sure foundation. So we need to be cautious about where we're placing our hope. Is it in God or is it in our bank account? And so that's the first way we fight the seduction, is by asking ourselves, where have you placed your hope? The second thing is this. In verse 18, look, all this message, we've been in one verse. Isn't that amazing? Now we get to go to verse 18. Paul writes this. He says, command them to do good, to be rich in good deeds, and to be generous and willing to share. You see, right away as Paul says this, to be rich in good deeds, what Paul is saying is there's multiple ways that you can be rich. Unfortunately for us, our culture, the climate around us says there's one way to be rich, and that's to amass wealth and stuff. And Paul's saying, time out here. Hold on. There's another equally viable and even more important way to be rich. And that is the second thing. Not just put your hope in God, but to do good deeds. You see, in the book of Matthew, Jesus is talking about stuff and being good stewards of what we have, and he gives people different amounts of, or the story gives different amounts of money to people, and they invest some of it, and some of them get returns, and one of them goes and hides it. And at the end of this story, Jesus makes the statement. He says, those that invested what they had and used what they had to do better things, he says at the end, he says, well done, good and faithful servant. And what that reminds, I tie it in with here, because it says be rich in good deeds. It doesn't say be rich in good thought. It doesn't say be rich in good intentions. He says be rich in good deeds. It requires action. Are we doing good? Be rich in good deeds. Be as rich in good deeds as we are in the balance of our checking and savings accounts. Are we doing those good deeds? And it's not, I'm doing my good deeds because I have to. It's, I'm doing them because I acknowledge the giver who has given me what I have. And I acknowledge what he's done for me, and therefore I want to reciprocate and do good for others. And the third thing that Paul says, the way we fight the seduction here is by being generous, being willing to share. And I'm up here today to tell you, anything you're willing to give, I will receive. I'm willing to do that for you just to help you be more godly. Just kidding. Wealth can make us self-centered. Wealth can make us so inwardly focused. And the way we combat that is by keeping our eyes open to the opportunities to do good and be generous to those around us. I want you to hear this. God is not saying give it all away. God is not saying make yourself destitute to where you don't know if you'll be able to eat. Now, maybe God will call you to, and that's between you and God. But do it if God tells you to, not because this sermon told you to. But what he is saying to us is he's telling us we need to be as generous to others as God has been generous to us. You see, sometimes I think we want to base our generosity on what the person to the left or the person to the right has done. And God says, that's not the standard here. I'm the standard. God is the standard. Jesus is the standard. And what did Jesus hold back from giving to us? And the answer was nothing. And we should be willing to be that generous with others. As I said, it isn't to be a good person. It's not just to fight the seduction of stuff. But when we move to verse 19, listen to what Paul says, a reason for doing this. He says this, he says, in this way, you will lay up treasures for themselves as a firm foundation for the coming age. He says, there's something else beyond this life. It's not just amassing stuff here and now and worrying about that. There's something to come, and there's treasures there. And you want to be thinking with that mindset of the things to come. And then catch this last phrase. He says, so that they may take hold of the life that is truly life. You see, the seduction of the world says amass stuff, and this is where life is found. And Paul says that's not it. Yeah, that is a counterfeit life. That is a false life that you will get sucked into and into this black hole that you don't think you can ever get out of. And Paul says here, he says, but there is true life. And true life is found when we place our hope in God, when we do good deeds and we are generous to others. That is where true life is found. And true wealth, as Paul is saying here, is not found in what we have, but in what we give. True life is the generous life. You see, I think as I thought through this message, I think every one of us could say, we don't need as much as we have. And when you evaluate what you have, can we say we're using it for as much good as we possibly could? You see, money is to be a tool that we use, but sometimes money becomes the user and we become the tool. You see, we're supposed to own money, but there are occasions where money actually owns us. How does that look in your life? Where is your hope? Is your hope in the provision or is it in the provider? Has stuff and your focus on it caused you to miss the abundance that you have? You see, when Jesus, when he talks about his economy and his way, he never looks at it from a position of self-preservation and scarcity. Jesus always sees abundance. And when we take our focus and get seduced by the stuff, what we see is self-preservation and scarcity. And that's a surefire sign that we are not focused on Jesus. Is your appetite for stuff out of control? Do you use the accumulation of stuff to meet a need that God wants to meet? You see, the way of Jesus offers an alternative to all the seductions that we've been talking about these past few weeks. But it will require us to go against the grain, to be countercultural. As we talked about that first week, for the seduction of status, the desire to make a name for ourselves, to prove ourselves, to reach for power. We reach for that. We're seduced by that because we believe that our status gives us greater value. And the more power we hold, the more people will respect us. But the way of Jesus shows us just the opposite. We find that status not by elevating ourselves, but we overcome the seduction of status through service. We go high by going low. It's easy to see how this could be very beneficial in our world today, instead of trampling one another to get to the top. From the seduction of sex, luckily last week we had our self-proclaimed sexpert, Ryan Lenners, to help us here. And we see that anything goes attitude in our culture, this if it feels good, do it, is not helpful. And in the way of Jesus, sex isn't a dirty word or to be avoided. God created sex for our pleasure. It's just to be enjoyed in a certain way, in a committed relationship between a man and a woman, where the drive is not how can I get my needs met, but how can I meet someone else's need, and how can I draw closer to God through this relationship. You see, we overcome the seduction of sex through sanctification or growing in faith. And then today we've seen that money isn't bad, and enjoying what God has to give you, it's not wrong. Being seduced by stuff and focusing only on self is. But the solution to the seduction of stuff is selflessness. Doing good things and sharing what we have with others. You see, my hope today is that as we consider these seductions that call out to us, we find ways to overcome them through service, sanctification, and selflessness, and find that contentment and peace and joy and love that comes from following the way of Jesus.